Hello, welcome to episode of the Always Be Comedy Audience Podcast. If you've not listened before, basically we chat with a different audience member each week rather than a comedian. And so this week we are joined by, I think I'm right in saying, our longest serving regular.
Oh dear.
But we're very grateful. There were some weeks when it was pretty much just this guy in the audience. So please welcome David Tinney. David, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me, James.
David, I've said this on stage before, but I don't know if it was true. Were you our very, very first one?
I remember I was here, it's my local, about 5.5 years ago when I saw a little sign on the bar, perhaps it was handwritten, and two, you know, destitute-looking gentlemen downstairs saying, please come upstairs, comedy in 10 minutes. And John and I, who love comedy, we always go to Edinburgh, we just said, hey, why not, let's go up and see it. And the rest is history.
So, David, obviously our listeners will know that you're... accent is not a Kennington.
No, it's accent. Not.
So where are you from originally?
Far west of Kennington. I'm from Dallas, Texas originally, via Boston. I've lived here for over 19 years.
Have you really?
Yep.
In London?
In London, yep.
Do you... So I'm from Leeds, so it'd be very easy for me to be critical of London, because a lot of Northerners have a chip on their shoulder. I fucking love London.
Well, I mean, why I moved to the UK is I like Britain now, but my original passion was... for London. I've been an Anglophile for most of my life and a London file, if that makes sense. And it could have been, I don't know, it could have been 80s pop music, which did it for me. It could have been episodes of Bad Fab. But in about 1997, I thought, right, if I don't do it now, after at a certain junction of my life, I'll never do it. And that was 19 and a half years ago.
You're joking. So it was purely a love of England that brought you over here?
Absolutely. It's passion for London. I'd been here as a tourist multiple times. And I just thought, right, if I don't do it now, I'm going to end up with a mortgage and a boyfriend and a car payment that I all hate. And I just said, fuck it. If I don't do it now, I'll always regret it. And I'm glad I did.
Because, I don't know about you, but I'll go, you know, I go to some cities. I'm dreadful to be on holiday with, because wherever I am, I always think it's not London, which is, I know, is a terrible attitude. But I go to some cities, and at first they're amazing. And then when I've been there a couple of times, my love ebbs away. But with London, I love it. More now than I did when I first moved.
I do the same thing. It's a city of constant discovery and just serendipity and just wonderful discoveries. And every city, with the exception of New York, I always say, that's a bit inferior, isn't it? You know, these bars, these restaurants are all a little bit, could be a bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you meet John here or in America?
Here, yeah. Well, not in this... But having said that, we had our wedding party in this very room 2.5 years ago.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So we are actually in the function room at the Tommyfield where we have Always Be Comedy. How did you meet?
We met, I'm not going to say we met online, but we met at a real, in a bar which has, through a website that has real life events in bars. A gay professionals website, they call it. We met there, and that was 13 years ago.
We've bumped into each other quite a bit. Like
at an art,
you're a very happy couple, aren't you? You
sure, are. Sure, yeah. We have our moments. After some bad comedy nights, we argue sometimes, but we move on from that.
Yeah, me and Stu argue after some bad comedy nights.
You're an old married couple too.
We are. So what was growing up in Dallas like? Because while you're Anglophile, I love America. So what?
Grew up in Dallas. I was very, very lucky to have very open-minded, liberal, left-wing parents. The whole sort of gay thing, the whole sort of... everything. It was a really nice experience. I had very, very progressive parents, very much urban-minded, and they didn't want to live in the suburbs or have me go to private school. Had public education, grew up right in the middle of Dallas, and when it got time for university, they said, you know, you just go wherever you want to go. And I knew I had to get out of Texas, although I had a great upbringing, and I lived in Boston. So it was good, a good upbringing. I mean, I'd love to say that it was oppressive growing up in the Bible Belt, but it wasn't for me.
So that's genuinely refreshing, isn't it? Because I imagine people who have heard your Texan twang will have heard that you're gay and would have assumed wrongly that, oh, Texas...
James, I would love to have this sort of oppressive narrative about growing up and being beaten up in school, maybe because I'm a big guy, it just never happened.
You know, I went to Texas a few years ago,
yep.
And I know that... I think the Bible Belt has an unfair rep, and I know Billy Bob Thornton has talked about this, Bill Burr, Norm MacDonald has certainly talked about it. It's almost the only place where it's almost acceptable for people to be sneering about it. You know, you couldn't get away with being that nasty about other parts of the world, but it's, for whatever reason, it's very easy for people to knock that area. But my experience was a wonderful one.
Well, I think also that is also a metaphor for America in general. I think it's very popular in this country to have TV shows and things in newspapers about America bashing, how horrible the guns are, how horrible the poverty problem are, about Donald Trump, about this. Louis Theroux has built a whole career on this sort of thing, about the crazy life of the Americans in general, and, you know, and especially Southerners. And it just really isn't true. There are intellectual Southerners, there are white trash Southerners, there are white trash people from New York and California as well.
Absolutely. Why is that then?
I think because America largely, and also Texas, presents itself as larger than life and a bit arrogant. And I think it's a way to knock it into shape and to touch a bit. It's not so great.
Because sometimes you'll see a comedian, and the gag is always that the South are backward, and it's all that. You know.
And a good example is every time a comic says, "Who here is American?" I always say, "Oh, for God's sake, here we go again."
I'll bet.
And from Texas, I sometimes get a shoulder from John, but I no longer speak up.
Because I mean, I've said this before on stage. A lot of Brits think it's cool to knock Americans. But yet, those very same people, the nanosecond that Helen Mirren is nominated for an Oscar, it's like the great, oh my God, or Coldplay gets a number one in America, it's like, oh my God, it's the greatest honour a Brit can achieve. You know, double standard, you know. So how do you go from Texas to Boston? What took you?
University life in general. I've always been interested and curious about people and how other people live and other ways of life. I love traveling, I'm passionate about it. And I just wanted to experience life in another part of America. So it's just sort of an organic progression.
And then how did... So, because that's a big move for an American guy to, based on his love of Ab Fab and all things British, how do you then... How did you engineer that move?
How I engineered it is I was in postgraduate school in Boston, and I just said, right, if I don't do it now, as I said before, I'm never going to do it. And I was sponsored by a local authority to live and do what I do for a living in 1997. And I just said, right, don't have much money, a bit skint, fuck it, I'm going to do it. And I made the leap. And yeah.
Best thing ever.
Best thing ever.
You're here for life then, aren't you?
Much to the consternation of my dad, I have a British passport now, so I'm not going back. He's horrified by the whole thing, James.
Does he come over here much?
Yeah, when he can. And we sometimes meet somewhere, if he's traveling, we sometimes meet somewhere else, like Spain or somewhere.
Can you ever get him down here?
No, he wouldn't understand it.
A lot of our audience don't understand it.
I think a non-British audience especially would understand it.
So I know what you do for a living. Can you explain to our listeners what you do?
What I do is I'm kind of a jobs body, psychologist come social worker, and I work, and I'm a manager, and I work indirectly with young people who are in foster care. And these are kids who have been fostered by a local authority. So it's kind of grim stuff. So I don't often bring it up in stand-up gigs unless I'm brought it into it by someone like James Gill.
But,
yeah, that's what I do. So comedy is a nice light relief for some pretty intense things in the daytime.
So my knowledge of this is zero. What does that entail then?
Yeah, a lot of people who live in places like Lambeth can't look after the kids for reasons of crack cocaine, heroin use, neglect, abuse, some kind of abuse, and they come into foster care. And I work for an agency that looks after foster children, and I supervise foster placements. Foster carers in the UK have a number of psychological assessments they have to undertake in order the process to become foster carers, and I kind of oversee that and manage foster care placements to make sure these kids have good outcomes and they grow up in a normal, stable environment as opposed to the chaos they were faced with their birth parents.
How do you get into that?
I just sort of drifted into it by different veils of psychology and social work. And I've always been interested, very, very curious for my life long about people, about what makes them tick, and working with children and families. And that was a job I liked and enjoyed working directly and indirectly now with young people in the care system.
Did you study psychology at uni then?
And social work, yeah, I am.
Holy fuck! So you're one of the few people I know who actually do for a living what they studied.
Yeah, but my dad said, you're going to end up, you know, working in The Gap or something. So I liked what it did and found somebody to pay me for doing it. So, hey, there you go.
Do you feel like, something I asked Rob last week, do you feel like this is it sounds like it. Is this your, if there is such thing as a calling, is this your calling?
A variation of this will be. Yeah, I like it. I'll do it of an age now where I'll do it probably until I retire. I won't have a career change. I've thought about it, but no.
What would the change might be?
Well, the funny thing is I thought for a long time, I actually thought about doing stand-up at some point, but I couldn't do it for various reasons. I've dabbled in it. I've done stand-up course. I've done improv. I was in a TV show called Come Dine With Me, and I don't have punchlines like you, and also get incredibly nervous. But I've always thought about something a little bit more public than what I do now, but I don't have the confidence or the nerves to pull it off.
Well, I get nervous and I don't have punchlines, so I think you should give it a go. What once happened, I once bumped into David and John, and John let the cat out of the bag that you'd once done stand-up, and he got the mother of all elbows into the ribs. Can you explain what happened when you dabbled? Because I think more people than you might realise would love to give it a go, but don't see it through, but it sounds like you actually...
I did a stand-up course. We had a showcase. I was terrified. I did an improv course. We did a stand-up. We did a showcase, and I was terrified. But really, the stand-up experience that I gained the most from, I've mentioned before, I was on a TV show called Come Dine With Me, which was the most fucking terrifying experience of all time. I thought it was about telling jokes and cooking and getting drunk. It's anything but that. It's cameras in your face, microphones in your face, sweating, and they feed you lines to say. There's nothing comedic about it. And it just, I was fascinated. By, like with comedy, what fascinates me about is how it works and how it ticks and fits together. I wished I could have been a tea lady in the back of set as opposed to underneath the camera. But it was absolutely terrifying. I was petrified by it. I'm glad I did it, but I just wish I could have done something backstage. I can't stand being in front of a camera, in front of an audience.
Oh, you were actually uncomfortable, the fact that you were in front of the camera.
I loved every second of it, but being when the camera was in my, and sometimes it was inches within your nose, I hated it. It was awful. I just still not watched the show.
So from when I've seen that show, it's not like I'm in my top 10 or anything.
Thank God for that.
But my wife is a huge fan. But when I've watched it, I'm very naive when it comes to stuff like this as well. So I'd assumed that, like yourself, it was a chance for the characters to really shine through and, you know, what you're cooking there, Dave? But nothing like that, I take it then.
No. It's all very, very mechanical. And they kind of tell you what lines to say. I cook Mexican food. And they said, David, is it Mexican or Mexicant? They said, say it to me, say it again.
No way.
I said, David, eat the food, take the food out of your mouth, look at me, look at my hand, eat the food again, now start laughing. And it was that way for about 7 hours each night. And I have such big respect for people on shows like The Bake Off, who can do it week after week. And you're drenched in sweat, and they wipe the sweat off of you, and then you laugh again, and then you take the food out of your mouth again. And it's totally... contrived. They're ever so nice, the producers,
sure,
and the
yes,
sound engineers, and the cameramen. They're really, really nice. But they have a job to do, and the job is not to make you feel comfortable. Their job, they're not social workers.
So from their point of view, because I personally would have thought, and what do I know, that it would be an organic experience, and then they edit, hey, let's make something out of this. But I guess from their point of view, they've got a formula that they know works. And
they've got a product, and it's like an assembly line to achieve. And so they're not, and one of the terrifying things, James, is how efficient they were. Stop cooking, cook again, stop cooking, and then run around you. And it was almost kind of like you were surplus to requirements, because they were making a TV show, and they would show you how to help them make it. So you were almost secondary to the production. They were trying to get out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And it was like an assembly line. Maybe you've seen this yourself if you've done any TV work. And if you were sweating, or if you were crying, it was an annoyance.
Sure.
They just said, stop it. Stop for 5 minutes. Can you stop? Now go back in camera. Do it again. And it was like that. There was no sort of sympathy. It was fascinating to see how they do it. I absolutely was intrigued by it. A bit like how comics do their craft. But being behind the camera, never again.
So you did your stand-up course. Then did you do some gigs after then?
We did a showcase. As often you do in these things. And it was in the West End. And it was... there were 10 people in my showcase course. There were 30 people in the audience, and 29 were my friends. One of the first And it was really, really interesting. It was really great. And in the stand-up course and in the improv course, they help you learn who your character is. They teach you mic skills. They teach you punchlines. They teach you the callback, They teach you audience participation. They teach you confidence. And it was really wonderful in terms of confidence building and also presentation skills and speaking before a crowd. And I learned a lot from it.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And it was on a much smaller scale than Come Dine With Me. I learned a lot about how to speak in front of... I would encourage anyone who thought about a stand-up course to do it if you're into public speaking or need to speak publicly in whatever arena.
So I would say one of the... You know, you've been at most of the amazing nights, but one of the most amazing things we've ever seen at Always Be Comedy, you know, we've had John Bishop and Mickey Flanagan and Catherine Tate and so on and so on, but one of the biggest laughs that this room has ever got was when you, Max and Ivan, got you up out of the crowd for the air guitar sketch. Do you remember that? It was... fucking sensational.
I think I vaguely did this. I've been drawn on stage so many times I get paid for it.
It was amazing. The gag was that you were supposed to take on one of them at an air guitar competition, and to say that you were a crowd favourite. Do you remember it, Stewie?
It's coming back to
you. It was amazing. No, it was brilliant. How many times have you been called up then?
I've been called up by Nina Conti, by a bando man multiple times, by that guy, by other comics. I've been humiliated, and I've said I don't want to sit in the front row, and I've been told you're not going to get drawn on stage, and I have been anyway. But that's okay.
I can remember those times.
That's okay.
Is there anything we can say that would cajole you back to giving stand-up a go? If it's not even something that you want to itch anymore, then no worries, I suppose. Is there a little part of you that thinks, oh, I'd love to do 5 minutes?
I would need to work, and one thing I learned in the course also that was helpful is writing, rewriting, editing, shortening things, and that was really helpful. If I could get a solid 7 minutes and have somebody proofread it and just say that's funny, that's not funny.
But sometimes the what's pretty strong on page can struggle live, and then what might appear pretty weak on page can take the roof off, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Who are your favourites who you've seen here?
It's interesting because some of my Always Be Comedy favourites are people who I ordinarily wouldn't have liked. I don't usually like Live at the Apollo kind of comics, but some of them you realise they're well known for a reason, like Jason Manford. I thought, oh God, he's on, and he was hilarious. And as I said to you before, James, it's amazing how they construct their craft. How he did, I think, 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Of, do you remember this?
I remember it very
stuff
well.
Off his sheets.
It's incredible.
And I can't believe that a lot of this is stuff he was testing. It was so polished. And he would call back things he talked about 20 minutes ago. And it was really amazing. Another people I like, and again, very different kind of comedy, is a bando man. And their ability and their memory of calling things back, their memory of, show me something out of your pocket, show me your pocket, and they make a rap out of it. I thought, how does their brain work, the rapper guy, the Irish guy, to make him come up with all these things? You must have this reservoir of things and this memory bank. And I think that's what makes a good comic, which I can't really do, is a memory bank of things you can reference and call upon. And you have to work really, really quickly in that way. And there's Russell Kane, another guy who wouldn't ordinarily like, can do that as well. He said, where are you from? From Texas. And he told two jokes about Texas. And I thought, shit, where did that come from? It just came out of the blue.
I think a Banderman, I mean, they're adored in this room. Our regulars love them. Comedians love them. I still don't think that they get the love and respect that they deserve. I think they're just jaw-droppingly talented, aren't they? And Russell Kane. So he was quite a nice story with Russell. So Always Be Comedy got to a point where it was doing fine. You know, we had acts who we liked, but we'd never had a megastar at the peak of their powers.
Yeah.
And Russell Kane was the first guy to come down as a superstar. And do you remember the first time he played?
I was here.
The noise was just... It was deafening, wasn't it? He just destroyed the place.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's always so nice of people who can really appreciate this room, maybe because they can see the entire room, and they can test out their craft, because usually they're in a room of 1,500 people, and here they are to 80 people.
And one other guy that you were impressed by was Sean Walsh.
I've always been impressed by Sean Walsh. And I tweeted him, as you know, just how... Again, and you always forget, he's only about 31 or 32. The way that his brain works, he can call back things. And again, that sort of drunk speech that he did earlier, that was his pre-Edinburgh thing, which is remarkable. And it was still a work in progress. And it was really, you can imagine what he's going to be like in 15. He's hilarious now, but in 15 years, this is a guy who's, you know, only 31 to 32. And it's just for a preview. It's the best preview, and I tweeted that to him, I've ever seen. It's remarkable.
From the first word out of his mouth to the last, it was... The thing with Sean as well is, he's hilarious, isn't he?
And what makes him hilarious is often it sounds like it's improvised. Like, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. Oh, excuse me. But it's very carefully crafted. But he makes it look like he's kind of making it up and kind of screwing up, when really he's not. I think a bando man kind of do that as well. Make it look like they're kind of messing this up or improvising things, and really they have it all planned out.
That's a fucking incredible skill, right. Isn't it?
Yeah.
So as working with the foster kids, has that always been the same job then?
No, I've changed. It's quite a stressful field. I've kind of chopped and changed jobs. I've done locum works. I've worked for local authorities. I've worked for private organizations. So I've not... Yeah, it's always... I sort of change every few years just to spice things up.
Have you ever had any hairy moments?
Hairy? I don't think so, because if you take things too personally... Kids who've encountered abuse and neglect in really heartbreaking situations, if you let it get to you, it stresses you out to the point that you can't do your job effectively. So you have to be somewhat detached from it. There are moments where I've been yelled at, screamed at, you're not doing your job right. I've had doors slammed in my face by young people, or I've been hit or punched or kicked, but you get used to it. It's a casualty. It's like being heckled in a pub. It's just kind of something you get used to. And if you let it get to you, yeah.
Sorry, go on, if you let it get to you.
If you let it get to you and you let it stress you out, then it compromises your ability to work with people effectively, and you get burned out. And that's the key, burnout. It's very analogous to being heckled. If you let it really get to you, it's going to affect you and compromise your ability to work effectively. It sounds very jargony.
I would love to know, as a very sensitive chap, I would love to know how you cope. Because, for example, if someone was to punch me, I'd probably have to go to a therapist. How on earth do you combat that medically?
I think the difference is you realize if I get kicked, one, it's by a child, but also it's by someone who's been damaged, and this is a manifestation of that damage and that frustration and pain, and not to take it personally. You might be able to internalize it by saying this person's really drunk. That's when they kicked me. I internalize it by saying this person doesn't know what they're doing. It's called displacement. They're displacing their frustration and anger at the situation they found themselves in by kicking me. And I'm merely the messenger telling them something they don't want to hear, which could be you can't live with your parents again. You're not going home. And they get frustrated and angry. But I'm just a vessel telling them the information that they need to hear. And if they kick me or yell at me or have slammed a door in my face, it's okay. If it wasn't me, it would have been somebody else.
So when you're telling them that they can't go with their parents, what becomes of them?
They go in long-term foster care. Or they can never see their parents again because their parents are dangerous. And sometimes it's very difficult, understandably, for a young person, because we know their life was chaotic and horrible. Their parents addicted to crack. To them, it was normal, and they don't understand in their 10, 8, 11-year-old brain why they can't go home to the mom and dad. And when you tell them that, it's very, very confusing, because to them, it was normal. Staying up until 2 o'clock in the morning, seeing your mother passed out on vodka on their sofa, it's a normal experience for them. So they kind of understand it, and they get angry.
What are foster homes... Foster homes good in this country, I take it.
They're wonderful, and they're very, very highly regulated and highly supervised, because they're looking after extremely vulnerable children behind closed doors, and so we have to make sure they're doing their job right. And it's all about child protection and child safety, and so the level of training that foster carers have to receive and continue to receive, and the assessment is very, very high. And if they don't, a lot of people who apply to be foster carers don't become foster carers because they don't meet the criteria, and the criteria, the threshold, is pretty high stuff indeed.
Are there many happy endings, I take it? You know, is it possible for these kids to...
What is a happy... A happy ending could be a young person is excluded from school only once a month as opposed to once a day. You have to establish what your threshold is. What I often say to carers is, don't expect them to become doctors. It might be somewhat, you know, it might become they can live on their own, and that is a marker of success. And a lot better marker of success than if they'd stayed in their birth home and they would have ended up in jail.
How can it get better?
I don't know. And if I knew that, I'd have the I possess a golden bullet, James. It's all I can help is better provision for looked after kids. And what our goal is, if we have one, is to stymie and to stop the cycle of poor parenting. So these kids who are with carers now won't grow up to be the same kind of parents there are, because their parents didn't know how to be parents, or their grandparents, or their great-grandparents, sure. Or a whole system. So our job is to stymie that and to end it, the cycle of bad parenting. So maybe the next generation will be different.
I was just going to say, can you actually diagnose comedians?
Well, what I find interesting is I've seen and met some comedians in Edinburgh who weren't performing like in a tent, and it surprises me how introverted and non-comedic they are when you meet them off stage. Almost shy. Not James Gill, but a lot of them I've met.
So I think Gary Delaney, who I think is wonderful, I wish he'd play here more often, he's played here once before. So Delaney has a theory that there are two types of comedians. There's the performer and there's the writer, and I totally get that. And Tina Fey, in her book, says there's Kirk with comedy. There's Kirk and there's Spock. So what she means, it's exactly the same sort of thing, really. Kirk is the outgoing one, and Spock is the more introverted one. So I would subscribe to is that some comedians are more gregarious and friendly. They're probably the more performer.
Yeah.
And then there are those who are more writers who are probably.
Yeah, and I've been to some comedy gigs where I have cheated on you, James, where you want to talk to the MC in between the acts, and they just want to run behind the curtain and hide. They don't want to engage the audience at all. It's because you think their persona off stage is going to be the same as on stage, friendly and telling gags, and often, sometimes, they just want to hide behind a bush between the acts. They don't want to talk to you. It's interesting.
Yeah, I found that fascinating.
And I found a couple of the comics that I've seen here multiple times. I saw them in Edinburgh in a tent, and I tried to talk to them, and they just oh, you saw me ABC?
Because I'd love to say who it is, and I can't, but let's just say that there are a couple of examples. Their persona is like the friendliest person in the universe, and then as soon as they walk off stage, no chat, you know.
And you know what? Maybe that's...
With everyone, you know.
And maybe that's sort of... A regulation valve. Maybe they can be so funny on stage and irregular that they have to be totally non-friendly or non-engaging. Maybe that's the way their survival mechanism. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Probably not.
No, it does.
I just made it up.
I would always thought. I think it was Ross Noble had said something similar. Where I thought that you want to be as true to off stage. You want to be as true to on stage as you are off. You want to. That's what your voice is. I mean, that can take. Years and years and years to get
there. Equilibrium. I think it takes a really talented comic to do that. And sometimes you'll see comics are hilarious and they go on Graham Norton and they can't really engage in a one-on-one conversation. Surprising. The comics who can do it well, like, I don't know, for instance, Michael McIntyre, are really, really famous. And that's because they can do it on stage and off stage.
So with your background...
John Bishop. Yeah.
I mean, John Bishop on a chat show is fucking born for that, isn't he?
Yeah.
Why can some people be hilarious on stage and then for whatever reason they're on a panel, they're on a chat show, it just doesn't...
They channel all of their what reservoir of gregariousness and being out there they have, they channel it all towards being behind a microphone. And there's no reservoir left. Perhaps all of their personality is just funneled into that 8 minutes they're on stage and afterwards they're drained. After they're on stage at ABC, they just want to get the hell out of here and go back to the tube station because they feel drained. And maybe they get, here's the theory, they get so much adulation, so many plaudits from people laughing at them that they say, okay, that's all I need now. I don't need to talk to people to get affirmation. I've just got all the affirmation by 80 people around me laughing. That's all I need. I'm out of here. Bye, James. See ya.
Well, maybe that's where we should end it.
Thank you so much. David, thank you, man.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. Please visit alwaysbecomedy.com for more information and for our live shows. We have gigs at the Tommy Field in Kennington weekly, every Thursday, as well as a new material night in Balham at the Exhibit, and that is monthly on a Sunday. Thank you so much. Take care.